few took cars or to 99 at point 30 hard blim police wreck this man next win sir police was sick as gun with seriums system. I don't know I had to crack back on fair beat. Why? Is if that fair beating was a tipping point. All scientists have decided again this crime. An estimated 170,000 people a day were entering the system by one route or another without paying a token. Some were kids who simply jumped over the turnstiles. Others would lean backwards on the turnstiles and force their way through. The problem was that once one or two or three people began doing it, other people, who might never otherwise have considered evading the law, would join in, reasoning that if some people weren't going to pay, they shouldn't either, and the problem would snowball. At the same time, fair beating was a difficult problem to fight. Because there was only $1.25 at stake, it didn't seem like the kind of crime to merit extraordinary measures. The transit police didn't feel like it was worth their time to stand by the turnstiles, when there were plenty of more serious crimes happening down on the platform and in the trains. Bratton quickly made his presence felt. He would roam the city on the subway at night, getting a sense of what the problems were and how best to fight them. First, he picked stations where fare beating was the biggest problem, and put as many as 10 policemen in plain clothes at the turnstiles. The team would nab fare beaters one by one, handcuff them, and leave them standing in a daisy chain on the platform until they had a full catch. The idea was to signal, as publicly as possible, that the transit police were now serious about cracking down on fare beaters. Previously, police officers had been wary of pursuing fare beaters because the arrest, the trip to the station house, the filling out of necessary forms, and the waiting for those forms to be processed took an entire day, all for a crime that usually merited no more than a slap on the wrist. Bratton retrofitted a city bus and turned it into a rolling station house, with its own fax machines, phones, holding pen, and fingerprinting facilities. Soon the turnaround time on an arrest was down to an hour. Bratton also insisted that a check be run on all those arrested. Sure enough, one out of seven arrestees had an outstanding warrant for a previous crime, and one out of 20 was carrying a weapon of some sort. Suddenly, it wasn't hard to convince police officers that tackling fare beating made sense. Under Bratton, the number of ejections from subway stations for drunkenness or improper behavior tripled within his first few months in office. Arrests for misdemeanors, for the kind of minor offenses that had gone unnoticed in the past, went up fivefold between 1990 and 1994. Bratton turned the transit police into an organization focused on the smallest infractions, on the details of life underground. After the election of Rudolph Giuliani as mayor of New York in 1994, Bratton was appointed head of the New York City Police Department, and he applied the same strategies to the city at large. He instructed his officers to crack down on quality of life crimes, on the squeegee men who came up to drivers at New York City intersections and demanded money for washing car windows, for example, and on all the other above-ground equivalents of turnstile jumping and graffiti. Bratton says, if you peed in the street, you were going to jail. When crime began to fall in the city, as quickly and dramatically as it had in the subways, Bratton and Giuliani pointed to the same cause. Minor, seemingly insignificant quality of life crimes, they said, were tipping points for violent crime. The broken windows theory and the power of context are one and the same. They are both based on the premise that an epidemic can be reversed, can be tipped, by tinkering with the smallest details of the immediate environment. They say that the criminal is actually someone acutely sensitive to his environment, who is alert to all kinds of cues, and who decides to commit crimes based on his perception of the world around him. The power of context says you don't have to solve the big problems to solve crime. You can prevent crimes just by scrubbing off graffiti and arresting fare beaters. The crime epidemics have tipping points, every bit as simple and straightforward as syphilis in Baltimore or a fashion trend like hush puppies. The essence of the power of context is that for certain kinds of environments, our interstates are the result of our outer circumstances. Once you understand that context matters, that specific and relatively small elements in the environment can serve as tipping points, the defeatism that for so long has characterized our approach to crime is turned upside down. Environmental tipping points are things that we can change. We can fix broken windows and clean up graffiti and change the signals that invite crime in the first place. Crime can be more than understood. It can be prevented. There is a broader dimension to this. There are a number of studies of things like juvenile delinquency and high school dropout rates that suggest that peer influence and community influence are more important than family influence in determining how children turn out. The studies show, essentially, that a child is better off in a good neighborhood and a troubled family than he or she is in a troubled neighborhood and a good family. We spend so much time celebrating the importance and power of family influence that this may seem, at first blush, like it can't be true. But in reality, it is no more than an obvious and commonsensical extension of the power of context, because it says simply that children are powerfully shaped by their external environment, that the features of our immediate social and physical world, the streets we walk down, the people we encounter, play a huge role in shaping who we are and how we act. It isn't just serious criminal behavior, in the end, that is sensitive to environmental cues. It is all behavior.